Professor Shannon Gleason. Professor Gleason is currently an associate professor of Latin American and Latino Studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz. She received her PhD in 2008 in sociology and demography from the University of California, Berkeley. However, in the fall of 2014, so next fall, she'll be joining Cornell's Industrial and Labor Relations School Department of Labor Relations, Law, and History. Her research focuses on the workplace experiences of immigrants, the role of documentation status, and forms of legal mobilization. And she has also conducted research on, and is doing so here partly in Toronto, on immigrant civic engagement and bureaucratic processes of labor standards enforcement. Her work has appeared in many periodicals. And she's currently working on a book examining the promises and failures of U.S. labor and employment law, the challenges low-wage workers face when they come forward to file a claim, and their experiences in fighting for justice. She's here at York this week as part of a visiting scholar program that is affiliated with the Closing the Employment Standards Enforcement Gap project that's based here at York. And this afternoon, she'll be talking to us about navigating the bureaucracy searching for justice, the promise and failure of workplace protections in the United States. Like certain elements of the Closing the Enforcement Gap project, her remarks will focus on the function of labor standards enforcement bureaucracy from the perspective of workers who've come forward to make a claim against their employer. So please join me in welcoming Shannon Gleason.
Well, thank you, Leah. That's a really generous introduction, and I just can't reiterate enough how wonderful it's been to be here these last few days. I think we as scholars can oftentimes get very kind of closed in our little bubbles, and we can say that a lot about just being in California relative to the rest of the United States, but I think even looking at this from another national context has been really illuminating. So I appreciate the opportunities that you've given me to converse with you guys about these different issues. And so, as Leah mentioned, I'm going to be talking to you guys about a project that I'm just now drawing to a close that's examining the experiences of low-wage workers in the San Francisco Bay Area. This is really a follow-up to my previous project, which focused more comparatively at the actual processes of implementing workplace rights in San Jose and Houston, where rather than look at an institutional analysis as I did in that book, I'm really interested in what's happening on the ground with workers themselves. I want to start simply, and I apologize to those of you who spoke with me a couple days ago because there will be some repetitive slides, but I want to start by looking a little bit, kind of a step back, and looking at what the landscape of workplace protections looks like in the United States, and simply to say that it's complicated, right? And so in this context, we have a number of different jurisdictional areas. This may look very familiar: union organizing, wage and hour, health and safety, discrimination, et cetera. And each of those have particular statutory protections attached to them. And we have jurisdictions at the federal level as well as at the state level. So, you know, the bureaucracy itself is a very complicated one, and one which does not, even for educated folks like ourselves, invite direct engagement. And so I was really interested in, for actual workers themselves who come forward and jump into the fray, which we know from the Law and Society literature is a very select number of workers, right? So the vast majority of workers who have something go wrong don't ever necessarily come forward, much less take it to the next level to file a legal claim. I was interested in kind of what happens once workers jump into that fray. And so I talked about this with you guys a couple days ago, but if we look at the standard process of filing a claim, just briefly, we know that it, you know, starts with a number of different kind of issues that an individual worker needs to be able to assess before they can file a legal claim, whether or not they're an eligible worker, once they've decided to submit that claim, trying to decide where to file that claim, at the federal, at the state, at the local level. They have to kind of garner the empirical evidence to present to these agencies. That might include witnesses. There may be statute of limitations that they are subject to. And in all of these aspects, a lawyer can be very vital, even though it's not required. And so what I was really interested in is where workers are falling at each stages of this process, trying to decide whether or not they're eligible for protection, kind of deciding where and to submit a claim, and you know, the challenges that they face bringing together these different pieces of requirements. And then also, once they've moved forward with a formal claim, what happens once they've done so at the investigative level, once they're deciding to settle their claim, and even once they've had a final positive judgment, what is the success that they have in actually getting restitution? So we know, and I'm sure things aren't all that different here, there's a number of different challenges facing the labor standards enforcement system, whether it be at the federal or at the state level. And particular workers, what Ruben Garcia refers to as marginal workers, which can include low-wage workers, immigrant and undocumented workers in particular, are poorly served by the apparatus that I just laid out in the slide before. Lots of research by your colleagues as well has focused on what Annetta Bernhardt refers to as this broken laws, unprotected workers paradigm, where we have this deep gap between the rights on the books and the rights in practice. How are those getting translated? And obviously lots of problems from, you know, uncovered workers, the fact that this is a claims-driven process, so those workers who come forward are the kind of key point to kicking off an investigation. Insufficient enforcement resources are a huge problem, and weak incentives on the part of employers to actually comply. And so within this context, we know that immigrant workers face particular challenges. And I'm going to kind of pop back and forth between thinking about the challenges facing low-wage workers more generally and those facing immigrant workers in particular. And the reason here I'm going to be focusing largely on the immigrant experience is because a large part of my sample, just given the low-wage workforce in the San Francisco Bay Area, is foreign-born. And so just to give you kind of an overview of what immigrant labor looks like in the United States, currently about 16% of all private sector workers are foreign-born. More than 5% or 1 in 19, it's 5.4, 1 in 19 workers are estimated to be undocumented, and these numbers are much higher in particular industries, including food processing, construction, and particularly farm labor. Now, compared to native-born and undocumented workers, native-born and other documented workers, the undocumented workforce faces particular challenges, both in terms of the precariousness of the jobs that they occupy, as well as this intersection between immigration and labor law. And so I just want to review briefly for you what that looks like in the context of the United States. In the United States, on the one hand, undocumented workers are considered to be deportable aliens. You may be familiar with a lot of these programs that are in place both at the federal level to police workers, surveil workers, both at the border as well as at the interior, and increasingly at the work site through programs such as E-Verify, and though not as much lately, but still in full force, the program of Social Security No Match Letters, which is a program that provided employers kind of a tip-off that their workers were, their workers' information was not lining up with what they had provided to the Social Security Administration, and then those notifications were often being used in exploitative ways at the time of union organizing campaigns, etc. So there's an increasing acknowledgement, even on the part of individuals and entities like the AFL-CIO, who at one point were very much in favor of employer sanctions, that these approaches to immigration enforcement are detrimental to worker rights. On the other hand, from the perspective of labor standards enforcement, these are protected workers. And as such, because of their particular vulnerabilities, are a major target of outreach on the part of both federal and state agencies, even in the wake of major Supreme Court decisions that have ruled negatively on the rights of these workers. And so at the local level, you see agents, and I've written about this in other contexts, really going out of their way to target this workforce. So in my project, what I was very interested in was trying to kind of pick apart how labor and immigration law are shaping the workplace experiences of individual workers, and trying to also look at what other legal regimes matter in this process. I was interested also in understanding how workers are gaining knowledge about their rights and what role what I refer to as bureaucratic brokers, such as the legal aid centers that I'm going to be speaking about, what role do they play in disseminating knowledge about rights, and what are the liabilities of a legalistic approach to rights enforcement, right? And so my research, I'm looking specifically at, you know, the barriers that workers face in filing a claim. As I mentioned, in the past, a lot of my work has focused on what keeps workers from coming forward, and now I'm interested in kind of what are those challenges that persist throughout the life of the claim. What are the threshold effects or the factors that workers use when deciding whether or not and when to come forward and file a claim? And in particular, I'm really interested in the immigrant experience in this process, but really trying to tease apart what is unique about that experience and what do those workers have very much in common, even with other forms of precarious low-wage workers. And so in this talk today, what I'm going to be focusing on is I'm going to start off by talking about some of the descriptive results from the survey of low-wage workers in the San Francisco Bay Area, and then I'm going to shift in the latter part of my time to trying to give you a flavor for some of the key themes that I've been uncovering through the interview material. So just to give you a sense of my methods, I draw primarily, as I said, on surveys at four workers' rights clinics in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I'll show you where those are located in a second. Just to give you a sense of what those look like, these are pro bono clinics that provide legal aid mostly on a one-on-one format, sometimes in a group format, to workers who have made the decision to come forward and pursue legal assistance in filing a claim against their worker against their employer. And so, in that space, when those workers were waiting for legal counsel, my team lurked in the waiting rooms to try to survey them. And we had about 20 minutes, and what we looked at during that process is what the conditions of work that they had experienced, what are the factors that they had faced in terms of trying to decide whether or not to come forward, and really trying to unpack what had happened if and when they had come forward to confront their employer about this issue. I think meaty part of this project is following up with workers 12 to 30 months after the fact. I had originally intended to do a kind of random sampling of my initial group of workers with the assumption that I could get a nice coverage of the original sample. But in practice, as we know these things happen, the workers who said that they were willing to agree to a follow-up interview were the vast majority of those survey respondents. In the life of a low-wage worker, 12 to 30 months is a long time, right? And so contact information didn't always persist, and people just had very complicated and busy lives, and for some of them simply didn't want to revisit the issue of this process. So in the end, we got about 20% follow-up of those initial workers, and I get kind of a range of time periods in the aftermath. On the one hand, there's a trade-off here that I just want to highlight. You need enough time to pass between when you talk to them at the beginning and the end to get any kind of meaningful follow-up. But again, in that process, you're losing people along the way, either because they've moved, phone numbers change, et cetera, et cetera. So those follow-up interviews will be the bulk of what I talk about today. As a complement to the kind of survey part of this in the Bay Area, I also have conducted an ongoing ethnography of the workers' compensation system, which is a very kind of unique part of the labor standards enforcement process, which relies largely on lawyers and the occupational health medical regime. And so in this process, I attended state workshops put on by the Division of Workers' Compensation for workers and kind of sat in on those over a period of four years now. And I also attended workers' compensation rights clinics at a local legal aid clinic in an agricultural community, and then did follow-up interviews with about 24 injured workers. So those findings are also inform my comments today. For those of you unfamiliar with the Bay Area, these are the sites. I had a couple of different sites in San Francisco, one in Berkeley, one in a high immigrant neighborhood in Oakland. One of the major survey sites was down in San Jose, and then the legal aid clinic was in a town called Watsonville, which is a highly agricultural community that serves largely farm workers, but not exclusively. Increasingly, that workforce has moved in either in the off-season or in some cases completely into the service sector. And just to talk briefly about the kind of what I refer to as the political field of workers' compensation enforcement, for the case of injured workers specifically, they, I think, provide, and I'll talk a little bit about them in the latter part, a really interesting lens into the kind of complicated process of bringing forward, in this case, a claim of for an injured worker, oftentimes we tend to focus on the employer, right? So the injured worker vis-a-vis the employer, and in some cases the state. But I think the workers' comp system, for me, in this process, really illuminates the relevance of other forms of expertise, not only lawyers, but also the medical profession and the insurance industry. So they're going to play a role in my remarks as well. So just to give you a sense, going back to the survey, you know, who are these folks? Who are, you know, what is the population of the Bay Area, and how does my survey compare? Overall, the San Francisco Bay Area is home to nearly 7 million residents, 43% of whom are non-white, so it's a very diverse place. Undocumented workers are particularly overrepresented in the state of California, also in the San Francisco Bay Area, somewhere on the order of 7.8% of the state, and this is even more so in particular areas. About 3.7% of San Francisco County workers are estimated to be undocumented, 8.4% of Alameda County, which is where Oakland and Berkeley is located, and in Santa Clara County, it's actually over 10% of private sector workers are estimated to be undocumented. Now, California, kind of as a case study or a lens for looking at this process, provides a best case scenario. We have some of the most stringent workplace protections in the nation. San Francisco itself and now San Jose have added additional local protections. However, what I really want to highlight is that there's this huge disconnect between, again, the nature of rights on the books and how they're being exercised in practice. So the survey that I conducted, if we compare that to the distribution above, just to give you a sense of who I was talking to, 3/4 of all the workers who attended these workers' rights clinics were foreign-born. Over half of them were non-citizen immigrants, and I estimate that about 1/3 of the respondents were undocumented. And I can talk a little bit more about that estimation process a little bit later, but just so you can get a sense of what that plays out as. In terms of racial diversity, and this is not a mutually exclusive measure, I have a largely Latino population. 2/3 of my respondent sample were identified as Latino, and then I have smaller numbers of white, black, and Asian Pacific Islander groups as well. And so I think in terms of what are the limitations of my project, I'll just highlight them here, or one of them is, in large part, what we know, I think, in the literature more broadly, and also in my project, draws heavily from the Latino immigrant experience. And we know that that is not the, you know, the whole of the low-wage worker experience. And I think that my sample reflects also the success that these advocacy communities like the workers' rights clinics have had in terms of moving into these low-wage worker communities in the Latino population, and the challenges that they still face trying to enter into other populations. So, for example, in San Jose, there has been a long, ongoing attempt to reach out to the Vietnamese community. In San Francisco, the Workers' Rights Clinic has tried to do additional outreach to the Mandarin-speaking community, and in the East Bay, particularly to the African-American community. But those numbers are not well reflected here. So I think there's a lot of work to do in these other communities as well. Just to give you a sense of the kind of the key characteristics of this worker sample, again, these are low-wage workers defined by their eligibility for services at these clinics. In other words, in order to qualify for pro bono legal counsel, they had to meet certain eligibility requirements, so that is kind of the main filtering of who these workers are. But within that, we see that a couple of things. One thing I want to highlight is that we tend to, maybe not in this group, but I think more broadly, assume that workplace violations are kind of the purview of the informal economy. But one of the things that I found is that actually 3/4 of all the claimants reported having taxes taken out of their pay. You know, a smaller percent, about 62% of undocumented. And if we think about that as an indicator of formality, we know that workplace violations are happening in both sectors. Only about 11% of the workers that I spoke to were paid in cash, and about 1/4 of them who were undocumented. We also know that an undocumented population relative to the others in the sample are overrepresented, particularly in the construction and restaurant industries. They characteristically, as we would imagine, had lower levels of human capital, About a quarter responded that they don't speak English. About half, less than half, possessed a high school degree, which actually struck one of my colleagues, and she asked me to, you know, is that really true? That seems very high, but it is. And so about less than half actually have a high school degree, representing the low levels of education, particularly of the recently arrived immigrant community. And these workers were on average 9 years younger than their, undocumented workers were on average younger than their than their documented counterparts and were more likely to be male. It just kind of gives you a sense of this. I also want to highlight that this was not entirely a non-union workforce. And so about 5% of the undocumented and over 18% of the documented were union workers. And so one of the things I highlight in the writings that I've done is that workplace violations happen even when you have a union. And in some cases, those grievances are perceived grievances are against unions themselves, which pose a particular challenge for the legal advocates. But this is one of the dynamics as well. I started out by asking workers a series of questions regarding their work history and the conditions of work over the last few years, and I'll just highlight a few of the findings from there. About 60% of claimants had experienced verbal abuse. 10% of male and 30% of female workers had experienced ever in their work history sexual harassment. 40% of workers had been threatened by their employer for complaining, and 70% of documented and 86% of the undocumented claimants had experienced some form of wage and hour violation. So I was interested in this kind of profile, number one, because I think that if we take kind of the wide scope of worker history, workplace violations are more the norm than not. And two, one of the things that I and other labor scholars have had to start to try to disaggregate is that what is statutorily considered to be a workplace violation versus what is simply an element of wholly legal elements of low-wage work also very much shapes the ways in which workers are experiencing power at the workplace. And so in the minds, for us as researchers, we kind of see the stark contrast, and especially as legal scholars, you know, what is legal, what is not. But in the minds of these workers, those divisions are often much more blurry. In terms of the type of legal claims that people were bringing, when I asked folks about the specific issue that had brought them to the legal aid clinic, and we talked in terms of issues, not necessarily statutory areas, because they weren't necessarily clear on that, 59% of undocumented and a quarter of documented workers were there for wage and hour problems, right? So we see that that is a huge element, particularly for that undocumented population. But there also was a huge number of folks who were in the other category. And you know, upon more digging, what this other category really meant is perceived wrongful termination, which in many cases they would come to find out actually was not a protected area in most of these cases who were at-will workers. And so most of workers were there either for wage and hour or what they viewed as being a discrimination issue, but a good chunk of workers were simply there because they'd lost their job and felt that they had done so unfairly. And so part of what they were there to do is try to understand how they could get their job back or how they could hold their employer accountable. And in the follow-up interviews, what I found is that many of them never had a follow-up interview with their legal counsel that they had met there that day simply because they didn't have protections under the law, right? Specifically looking at the foreign-born experiences, I just want to highlight a couple of trends that I found in the survey there. Oftentimes in the immigration and labor literature, we tend to focus on this kind of overt forms of retaliation on the part of the employer. We know, and there's been long-standing evidence, that undocumented workers face particular challenges. Now, one of the things that I wanted to highlight here is that when we focus specifically on these overt threats related to immigration, either through whether or not there had ever been a raid at the workforce or having direct threats from the employer, very few workers you see here at the bottom ever said that they had had that experience. And if we were kind of just focused there and say, well, this may not, you know, this isn't an issue, there's raids aren't happening, they're not being kind of, they're not having their immigration status held over their head, we might get a very different story from how immigration status is actually factoring into the workplace experiences and the claims-making behavior of these workers. Despite not having experienced a raid or overt threats, many still discussed consistent fear, but not so much of deportation, but of job loss, right, and the economic precarity that would come with that, which was multiplied by their undocumented status, right? I also asked workers whether or not they ever felt that They had been targeted for workplace abuse because of their immigration status, and about 80% of the documented or 90% of the undocumented felt they had been. So there's this kind of paradox. On the one hand, it is playing a role, but not necessarily in the overt ways that we would expect, and this has been salient in my interview work as well. I'm not going to belabor the multivariate results because I want to get to some of the follow-up interviews, but just to highlight, I asked workers again this question of their experience with workplace violations, wage and hour violations in the past, and the clear risk factors that emerged for wage theft are ones that we're all fairly familiar with. Particular industries, including restaurant and the construction industry, are overrepresented here. Those who are subject to cash payment and those who are estimated to be identified as undocumented are also more vulnerable to wage theft than the others that were there at the workplace. And then one thing I wanted to highlight is that those who identified as white also were more likely to have identified a violation of wage theft in the past. Now, I highlight only that because this is, on the one hand, we would assume that that population would be less likely to have that experience, but one of the things that this is kind of forcing me to pick apart is kind of how do workers themselves identify wage theft specifically? And for these white workers who in this context tended to be unemployed professional workers or white-collar workers, kind of their knowledge and understanding about the law tended to be more sophisticated. So I think that I need to kind of explore what the particular experiences of those workers were. A couple of other things to highlight. It's not the case that the workers who had come forward to seek help from these legal aid clinics had stayed quiet when a workplace violation occurred. In fact, 70% of the workers we surveyed had confronted their employer prior to visiting the clinic. Obviously, the workers who had reasoned with their employer and gotten the issue resolved aren't represented here, but we know that escalating a claim beyond their employer can be a risky prospect for these folks. And so even though the statutory protections mandate that firing a worker for complaining constitutes a form of illegal retaliation, at-will employees, in other words, those who don't have a union contract, can be fired for a number of business reasons, right? And so in practice, this claim of retaliation can be very difficult to establish. And so the stark reality is that only 20% of my survey respondents were still employed in the job where their claim emerged. And amongst that 70% of workers who tried to resolve the issue first with their employer, about 38% reported that their claim was ignored, 8% said that they were threatened, and 14% said that the issue was initially resolved but then resumed. And so amongst those 30% of workers who chose to avoid a confrontation with their employer, about 5% reported that a language barrier was their major deterrent. 17% said that they were afraid simply that coming forward would affect their job. And 19% they simply said didn't think it was going to do any good, right? So the questions of efficacy in the claims-making process are raised here as well. Now, when I look at this in a multivariate context, which I've posed to you here, there's no discernible pattern regarding what type of clinic attendee chose to speak to their employer first, but the thing that does emerge is that those with, in the wage theft context, those with less than a high school degree stand out as having a much lower log odds of approaching their employer. So that was the one kind of significant thing that emerged. But I was also interested in the communication that happened with work with employers following their that violation, right? Among those claimants that did choose to approach their employer first, two categories of claimants were significantly more likely to report that their employer had either threatened to fire me, cut my hours if I complained, and those who said that they did not speak English at all, and those who were in the restaurant industry. So we might want to think about the particular context of precarity for those. Not surprisingly, these same two categories of workers were more likely to cite that they were afraid that complaining would affect their job, those who were restaurant workers as well, right? I also was interested in, you know, why were workers coming to the legal aid clinic? Why didn't they just go directly to the government agency? In our area, the state labor commissioner, for example, is the primary place where workers typically go. And I asked folks, you know, whether or not they had tried going to an agency first. Now, this sample obviously doesn't, like before, doesn't represent those claimants who resolved their claim directly with the labor commissioner, but 40% of the workers in my sample actually said that they had tried going directly to the government agency first. And those who were undocumented were statistically less likely to have gone directly to a government agency. Not surprising. Not your funnest thing to do, to waltz up to a government agency if you are undocumented. And native-born claimants had a longer experience with claims making. About a quarter of them had actually filed a claim before. But when I look at this in the multivariate context, several key characteristics predict whether a claimant had gone directly to the government agency before seeking help. The worker's human capital doesn't seem to predict whether they had gone to the agency for help before, but those who were paid in cash were less likely to have gone to the government agency first. And again, those wage and hour claimants, not surprisingly, were more likely, probably because the kind of bar for establishing that claim is much lower than it is for, say, discrimination. And again, those who had the good fortune to still be employed at their job were also less likely to have gone directly to a government agency first. Oftentimes I found trying to kind of suss out what their options were before taking that next step. However, what I want to highlight is that going to a government agency does not necessarily mean that they were going to file a claim, right? So 20% of the respondents who visited the government agency went on to be referred to the clinic directly from that agency, right? And the proportion of direct referrals from the government agency was even higher for those who are either foreign-born, who are not native speakers, and who are undocumented. So what you see is that these legal aid clinics are functioning as a sort of ancillary to the government apparatus in the case where either those agencies don't have the resources to handle claimants who may need additional assistance, right? And we know that that was particularly the case prior to this survey, State of California went through a furlough period. So in addition to the already very taxed resource context that they were operating in, they had every third Friday of the month off. And so their ability to handle their caseload was even more radically reduced. But as I mentioned yesterday, it also may be a function of the fact that these agents are supposed to be neutral in their approach and their ability to advocate for these workers who may walk in with nothing at their side to establish their claim. Their best way to help them kind of come back with a stronger case was to refer them out. But the kind of burden that places on these legal aid clinics is significant, and it's an unfunded burden. So just in summary, and I won't belabor the numbers much longer, as I mentioned before, the risk of wage theft for these workers is particularly salient for the restaurant and construction industries, those who are cash payment and the undocumented. Those who were threatened after confronting their employer directly was particularly experienced by non-English speakers and restaurant workers. Similarly, for those who chose not to go directly to the employer. And again, we know that there's these number of risk factors for those who don't go through the formal system first, right? So, you know, these are some of the things that I was interested in looking at through the surveys. But then the next step of this and what I want to spend the remainder of my time speaking about is, okay, for these workers, after they left that context, what was their experience? And as just a point of overview, I just want to highlight kind of some of the key themes that I uncovered in my interviews, and then I'll want to spend some time focusing on what I kind of call the gap between lay forms of or lay conceptions of justice. What do workers think they deserve versus what the law says that they are entitled to? But, you know, a number of different themes emerged in the follow-up interviews. One was the fact that workplace violations often required a sort of triage on the part of legal aid lawyers. In other words, there's a whole bunch of things going on, but which one of these is likely to be more successful? Workers also talked a lot about this long timetable of justice, somewhere on the order of 1 to 3 years, even longer that it took even to get a successful judgment, and if there was bankruptcy, et cetera, what it took to actually get their restitution. And so a lot of weariness about the time that this was taking. I also talked to workers about the kind of far-reaching potential of employer retaliation, even though there are some provisions for this in the labor code. Employers aren't just using the experiences of these claimants themselves. as a point of retaliation, but it's particularly in the agricultural sector where you have entire families who might be blacklisted or kind of dense social networks in terms of hiring. Say, for example, in the restaurant industry, employers were targeting kind of folks affiliated to these claimants as well. There's lots of gaps in the coverage of the law, kind of where workers think that they're covered versus where the law says that they are. The steep burden of evidence, workers simply not being able to garner the documents necessary to establish that there had been, for example, an incident of wage theft, and trying to get people to come forward on their behalf was a challenge. And then as I looked at, particularly in the workers' comp system, this very kind of complicated bureaucracy that involved not only the state agencies or the employers, but also these multiple gatekeepers. And for injured workers, this included medical experts and legal experts, the voice of whom often trumped their own. And right, so a lot of challenges that they faced there. So in this kind of second section of my discussion, I wanted to kind of highlight some of the ways in which low-wage workers perceived justice, right? Their views of justice in the processing of their workplace violation claims. And I want to highlight kind of two orientations towards worker rights that I uncovered. The first we can kind of characterize as a more affective stance rooted kind of general convictions of right and wrong, right? And here, the initial impetus of workers to come forward and file a claim in the first place, even in the absence of understanding what the specific legal protections were, was really the fact that they had been wronged, right? What I find often, though, is that this stance often shifted over time to a more rational or pragmatic approach to their claim, which weighed the cost and benefits of persisting throughout the life of the claim in litigation or ultimately in settlement or in abandoning the claim. And so what I am playing around with at this stage, and I would love to get your feedback, is how the process of claims making looks for low-wage workers engaged in this process and how their visions of justice are differing from the ones inscribed in the law, right? And so I want to highlight, and I don't have time to go through this in detail, but I want to highlight kind of three areas or three vantage points that we can maybe take to understanding where these gaps emerge. One is the process of establishing the claim, kind of how are people deciding whether or not to move forward. Next is how are they, you know, what are the issues that emerge in the process of navigating the claim, and in particular, workers talked about their desire to have time from their legal representatives, from their medical providers, from the hearing process, and also respect and how they experienced kind of forms of disrespect in this process. And then in the last part, kind of the time and opportunity costs analysis that these workers were making when trying to decide whether or not to continue a claim, stop a claim, abandon a claim, whether to move on or keep fighting. And then what I'm really interested in is the fallout, right? And I'll give a couple of examples of where that fallout was rather tragic. So I'm going to give you some kind of a texture of the interview material here. I'm not going to go through all of them, but you can read along as I go, and I'll kind of highlight what I saw at each of these stages. So in this beginning stage, aggrieved workers had to assess whether the law was going to serve them in their quest for justice. And so I talked to workers, you know, about, you know, their own rationales in this process. They had to begin by trying to, you know, get a sense of whether or not they were eligible for coverage. Oftentimes this involved engaging with legal advocates who provided them information about whether their claim was worth pursuing, right? And the many of the workers that I interviewed never made it past this first stage, right? While some were referred to the legal aid clinic directly by labor standards enforcement agencies, as I've already mentioned, for most, this was their first stage of legal mobilization and oftentimes their last. And so I'll give you an example of Dana, a Korean office worker in her 30s, who was there seeking legal assistance to complain about what she thought was an inappropriate level of instability in her job. She had been labeled an independent contractor, paid in cash, and she was very frustrated by her unpredictable work schedule. She explained, "I ended up calling an employment lawyer. He didn't call back. Then I called another. They didn't call back. It just seemed like a dead end. If you want to give me no hours next week, there's nothing I can say because I'm an, quote, independent contractor. I'm paid under the table, and I didn't meet any of the criteria for coverage. So I just didn't have any power." Similarly, Ramon, who was a Mexican immigrant handyman at a apartment complex where he'd worked for nearly 20 years, had been fired following a single negative review. And there was some backstory here about a family member who the new manager wanted to hire. And he talked about kind of his experience and the revelation he ultimately had that he had no rights. He said, "I stupidly didn't keep notes. I thought she would see my work, but she didn't. I took to the law center what notes I had, and they weren't conclusive of discrimination of any kind. They didn't say such and such time, this happened, or show that one person was treated differently from another. But I didn't think that, he didn't think that this was going to be a problem," right? So for many of them, it was kind of the realization that they didn't have rights posed a major, a barrier and kind of a demoralizing effect. Now, in the process of actually navigating the claim, once that claim had been established, additional challenges emerged in their attempt to shepherd their claim through the system, which often involved kind of navigating this complicated bureaucracy, summoning various sources of objective evidence. And in doing so, oftentimes a claimant's voice can be lost behind the backdrop of other forms of technocratic expertise. And many of the workers I spoke to were simply frustrated that their perspective and literally their voice was not being heard. They also had to make determinations about how far and how hard they wanted to fight and which time and opportunity costs were worth foregoing. And so for those individuals who had originally chosen to fight for their claim, they often had to reassess this logic in terms of deciding whether to continue doing so later on through the process. This came up, for example, in cases where they were offered mediation and settlement, which has increasingly become kind of a mandated aspect of these hearings processes and are seen as a cost-saving measure to reduce litigation. But during this process, we know deals are struck off, and workers have to weigh whether or not these very limited settlements are worth kind of foregoing the prospect of a lengthy hearing and trial. And so throughout this process, there are a number of factors that workers discussed as disempowering, including a lack of access to key brokers and experts, issues with language and communication during appointments and proceedings, despite the fact that they were entitled to interpretation, which wasn't often a very good quality, and then also the time, the monetary, and really largely the emotional cost of endless wrangling with the system. So just a few highlights on this matter. And the issue of time and respect, I spoke, for example, with Mario, who was a Salvadoran construction worker who was there actually in temporary protected status, which is a particular kind of temporary visa category. And so he had a litany of complaints, in this case, about his union's mishandling of his salary and pension commitments. But, to talk you through his experience, he says, "The clinic told us that we had let too much time pass for our demands between the time when we were owed our wage and when we filed the claim. Too much time had gone by, and they said they couldn't help. I don't understand. Was it from the time when they owed us the correct benefits or the time when they should have given us back the check stubs? It was like 2 to 3 months. And ultimately, the union member who was helping them had been replaced, and nothing was able to be done to remedy the case. And even though he could have continued fighting, he said, we didn't do anything else. We just didn't mobilize more. Eleanor, another woman who had fallen and injured her thumb, she was a child care provider and mother too. She talked about kind of the very challenging aspect she had in terms of the medical provision. So something called a qualified medical examiner, whose job it is to examine what the percentage of your disability is, and then a very literal cost is attached to that, which determines your settlement. What I found really upsetting about this specialist is that if she spent 5 minutes with anyone, it was a very long time. She spent 30 seconds with you. You were like cattle. You were sitting in a long row of chairs outside her office. She would come to the door and she'd call Eleanor and she would leave the door open, like HIPAA, which is a health privacy law, which didn't apply for her. So in her case, it was the treatment that she experienced with the medical expert. And even Ben, an older white veteran who had attempted to contest his unjust termination and actually went on to win, he talked about kind of the very demobilizing experiences that he had just sitting there in the courtroom being hassled by the attorney. Another issue that came up was workers' desires to, very literally, their material and their files. So many of them talked about the challenge that they had even getting that final judgment from the agency. Alfredo, who was an undocumented Mexican auto body specialist, had been wrangling with the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, demanding the status of his case. And he wanted to see the actual letter saying that his case had been closed. And in the absence of that, was not going to back down. and remained rather indignant. Wendy, who was a high-level Asian American municipal employee, had a 3.5-hour interview with her in her home, and at the crux of this was the quality of her medical report. And so she had asked for a copy and found that there were a number of different mistakes. She said, "When I read through his report, so many mistakes. He had even mentioned someone else's name on the report. He got the dates wrong. A lot of explanation I provided him was just not right. And he cited my background because I was born and raised in China, went through the Cultural Revolution, went back to work in the countryside. He asked me all my family background information, my past life. Because of this report, what he concluded that my sickness was because of my personality." So for her, kind of the stark contrast between what a person who she had just met and her evaluation of her case, and her entire case came to hinge on that report, and his mischaracterization of her case, and then her never-ending quest to get a copy of that medical report, which she was never successful at doing, was the bigger injury in this process. And so lastly, I want to talk about the process of evaluating the claim. So there came a point for all the workers I spoke to that they had to decide whether or not they were going to keep fighting for more, settle, or simply move on. And so several considerations emerged during this process, and I want to talk about two in particular, which is kind of time and opportunity costs. And I don't need to overly rationalize what is going to be a very subjective process, but what I want to kind of highlight here is that oftentimes when these workers were choosing not to move on, they had good reason for doing so, not simply because they felt that they didn't have... there's a power imbalance here, but they were taking over agency in this process and establishing, you know, what was important to them by this point. And so I talked with these workers, for example. I spoke with Lino, who was an undocumented Mexican immigrant who had been in the U.S. for about a decade and worked as part as a landscaping crew for a small tree service. Long story short, he and a variety of other crew members had filed a claim, and he had actually chosen to not file a claim with them. And so I asked him why, and I asked him, now that they were actually successful, they had gone on and won their case and actually moved back to Mexico with their settlement, why he chose, because he was still within the statute of limitations, why he chose at the time not to go forward and why he was still ambivalent about doing so. And he explained that it all came down to time. He said, "I simply didn't have the time to attend the appointments necessary to move his individual claim forward." So time meant lost wages from his current job that he went on to get, and time also meant the very limited time that he had with his family. And actually going forward to all these appointments was not so much a matter of the time, which he could get off, but he talked about the complicated process that he'd have to give his current employer to justify why he needed that time off and why how he would be branded as a troublemaker if he explained why he needed these particular days off was something he simply wasn't willing to do. I talked to a number of different workers about their decision and their fundamental need to simply move on. Merlin, an undocumented machine operator from Peru who had been injured on an assembly line, talked to me about his calculation. He was an older gentleman, and he said, "The truth is they wore me out." They, referring to the workers' compensation attorneys from the insurance company, said, "I saw that there was not much else that could be done." He also wasn't very prepared for the very aggressive lawyer that he had to experience on the other stand. He said that it was my fault. It was uncomfortable. He was direct, aggressive, and intimidating. I knew that there was no way I was going to get totally better and that there wasn't more to do. And so for him, actually kind of settling the case, remaining at his current job, knowing that his ability as a late 50s injured worker to get a new job was limited, kind of going quietly into the backdrop became the easier approach for him. So I asked him about what his current goals were, and he says, "The only thing I want is to keep my job and stay healthy. I complete the basic requirements. I show up, put in my 8 hours of production time. For now, that's the best I can hope for." Combined with his undocumented status, and he doubts that he's realistically going to be able to find another job because of the physical toll that this has taken, he knew that his best bet was simply to hang on until he could find a less physical job. But until then, it wasn't worth continuing to fight. I also talked to workers who had the opportunity to kind of mobilize their coworkers around this issue, and In the case of Margaret, who was a Filipina caregiver, she explained to me that even though she had had the opportunity to kind of mobilize her coworkers who had had similar experiences, she explained that she simply decided that she had to live her own life. She gave up the case and chose not to continue kind of the organizing work simply because of the toll that it had taken, and she decided to move on and turn her pursuits elsewhere. Okay, and so what about those who decided to keep fighting? I wondered, you know, what is it that propelled these workers to make these sacrifices? Marta, a naturalized citizen from the Salinas Valley who spoke very little English despite living her whole life in this region, explained to me her kind of central conviction that she simply didn't agree with the logic of the workers' compensation system. She was in a particular privileged status because she could rely on disability and the rest, but she simply said, and I'm sure to her insurance company's dismay, that she could not bring herself to what she referred to as sell her health, right, to put a dollar value on this long-term back injury. Others, as I mentioned before, Alfonso earlier, he had continued to pursue his unjust termination case for close to a decade simply because he had refused to accept that his case had been closed, right, and continued to seek out assistance from other places beyond the bureaucracy who had continued to ignore him. But some workers had looked back on their decision to keep fighting positively, but what I want to highlight very cautiously, one of the things that we would assume is that one instance of positive claims making would propel new instances. And I think that is the case in terms of kind of selective empowerment. In the case of JJ, an undocumented Mexican construction worker who had been able to win nearly $10,000 against a contractor who had owed him unpaid wages in the spanning 2 years, I asked him about his new position. We were talking at the time, and he talked about his current situation where he had experienced similar forms of wage theft, and asked, well, you know, are you empowered? Do you feel like, you know, you can come forward and do this again? And he said that he had had a previous experience to the job that he currently had where he had warned his employer. He said, let this be a lesson to you this time, but the next time I will take you to court. Take all that you have and leave you in the street begging. And so on the one hand, he was empowered. His experience had really propelled him forward. But then I asked him about his current job where he hadn't done anything about the current issues that he'd face. And he knew that his boss was accountable. And he said that, you know, in some ways, even though he had been empowered, some of the same patterns were continuing, right? He explained to me that he's simply adjusted to the low rates of pay, that in other facets, given even though he's not getting paid overtime, et cetera, it's a good job, and that he had gotten used to kind of the rhythm of that particular job. So it's not the case that he's going to become a claimant in all situations. He's continued to do so very selectively. I want to end by highlighting the experiences of kind of two women in particular who had gone through this process of claims making. And again, this issue of claims making as disempowerment. For both of these women, the lesson learned from coming forward and filing their claim wasn't that they were entitled to rights and that they would continue to fight for them, but that the next time something happened, they were going to keep their mouths shut. And I just want to relate to you these two examples. In one case, Lucrecia, who was an undocumented mother of two, had filed a claim for overtime. She said, with relation to her own case, she said, in reality, there was no resolution for me. It was frustrating because I felt that although the agency had helped us, I felt that they didn't act or orient us enough so that we could come to an actual monetary agreement. The owner declared bankruptcy one day to the next, so you have to realize he got nothing. He just declared bankruptcy and the case was closed. She had also had challenges getting into the agency to follow up with her claim because she didn't have the appropriate documents, which is actually should not have happened, but it did. And so for her, it was just a one big bureaucratic hassle that she wasn't, as a mother of two young children who was breastfeeding, et cetera, not going to waste her time on. Gloria, I think, in many ways represents kind of the ways in which these things can snowball into a number of different areas. She was an undocumented lesbian woman from Mexico City who had been sexually assaulted by a male supervisor at the unionized maintenance job where she had worked. For her, the experience of this process was wholly disempowering. In the process, she lost her job, which was a very well-paying job at the time, $15 an hour, which is a fortune, small fortune for her. It was unionized. It had benefits. She was in a two-bedroom apartment with herself and her sons, and But when she lost her job, all of that went away. And she explained to me kind of how she looks back on this. She says, no, they didn't give me my job back. That's the bad part. I was the victim in this case. They took my job. The man went to jail. I filmed it. She was able to film some of the abuse. They took all the proof to the police. Everything was proven. And now I wonder, why did I speak up? I ended up without a job. I ended up with all sorts of problems. And she lost her relationship in the process. Her son had been sexually assaulted at the home where they were staying temporarily. And she said, why did I speak up? I should have stayed quiet. I would have kept my job. My economic state would have been better because that was a good job. My son's rapist went to jail and now he is out. My aggressor went to jail and now he is out, but I am left here with nothing. So in many cases, these weren't positive experiences that these workers had, and their sense of kind of justice in the system was much more overshadowed by the fallout that the process itself had brought to their lives. So I don't want to end on an entirely negative note, but what I want to highlight in this kind of discussion are the limits to lawyering from the perspective of workers themselves who have turned to the legal system to resolve their claim. And so I think we and other labor scholars are interested in kind of understanding what are the other approaches for worker empowerment that aren't necessarily confined by the litigation process. What I also want to highlight is that beyond these egregious violations of workplace laws, my findings also uncover several instances of, as I mentioned, completely legal workplace practices that were nonetheless characteristics of, you know, bad jobs or precarious work. Just to highlight a few of them, 42% of all respondents never had received safety training, 53% had never received a raise, 38% were never provided sick leave, only 46% were provided paid vacation, and health insurance was an issue as well, and it'll be interesting to see how that changes with the Affordable Care Act. In reality, I think at the core of one of the questions that we as labor scholars in the United States have to really confront is what is the role of at-will employment in this process? And I think that is at the base of a lot of these discussions. In follow-up interviews, I've also tried to highlight these kind of three main kind of vantage points in the claims process where workers are evaluating their positionality, you know, whether or not they're covered and their eligibility, whether or not they're deciding to move forward with the claim, and under what, you know, conditions, and kind of looking back what they feel that they have gained or lost. And so what I want us to kind of start to problematize is the demobilizing effects of rights protections and institutions, which is not a new area for law and society scholars. We've looked at this, for example, in the context of sexual harassment and race discrimination with Kristen Buemiller's work. But I wanted to kind of think about this kind of evolving perspective on justice and how kind of cautionary tales can proliferate in social networks just as well as successful tales can, right? And so how these become precedent for how workers move forward. And what I want to kind of centralize here is the agency of the claimants themselves. On the one hand, balance kind of the structural limitations that they face in this system, but then the areas in which they're really trying to exercise agency, right? So I want to end there and, you know, invite any questions that you might have, and I really would encourage you to show me where I have holes in my analysis and where I might be able to think more critically about this. So I appreciate it, and I welcome the responses that you have. Thanks.
Thanks.
Yeah.
We have the room until 1:30, so plenty of time for discussion and questions. Maybe what we could do is...